This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face-to-face with business decisions. Online at www.bgov.com and, of course, on the air right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, where this week we're going to dive back into the economy, so to speak, with our favorite economist. She is senior economist here at Bloomberg Government. Her name is Dr. Neela Richardson. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's 2014. First time back in 2014. So it's good to have you here. Did you have a happy new year?
I did. How about you?
I did. I bought some money cologne. See, I'm going to spray a little, put a little. You smell it? Mm-hmm. I smell like money, don't I?
You smell like money.
I smell like money, which is a good thing because money, as it turns out, this year and late last year, in the past few years, has been a little tough to come by for quite a few people. Looking at the jobs market as a whole, the report came out recently, didn't look very good. What are the plans? I got a lot to talk to you about here. So why don't we dive in first? Let's talk about income inequality.
So income inequality is a very real issue in the economy right now. Since 1999, median incomes have fallen 9%. Over the past 15 years. That's a significant decrease. And all of the gains made since 2010, since the end of the Great Recession, have been attributable through the market to the upper income households. So that's only worsened income inequality overall. And so this is a very real issue. It's also a piece of rhetoric that will be used over and over again in the lead up of midterm elections as Democrats seize this issue and are starting to make it their theme for the year, and Republicans are forced to find an answer to this growing problem of income inequality.
So I had as you talk about elections coming up, I'm now thinking about a presidential election, and you mm-hmm. think that Hillary is likely going to at least I feel that Hillary is going to jump into the fray. And what better running mate for Hillary Clinton than somebody like, I don't know, former Senator Tom Daschle mm-hmm. to be on the ticket? How cool would that be if the two of them were to get together? Look at that. She's reserving judgment. I get it. You're remaining impartial, walking the line. I understand, but I do have a point here. The point is the ideas that each side comes to the table with, the Republicans being the conservative side, the Democrats being more verbose, so to speak, and more liberal with their ideas. This is a big deal.
It is a big deal, but it's important to get the story straight. So in terms of...
So who do you believe?
You know, there's two ways to answer the problem of income inequality. The first is to grow the pie, and the second is to redistribute the pie. And it doesn't take a stretch of the imagination to realize which parties fall along what lines.
Right.
What we've seen in the most recent data put out by the Congressional Budget Office is that the United States does actually a very good job of redistributing the pie during a recession. In fact, during the recession, the top income earners lost about one-third of their income, while the middle income households only lost about 1.5% of their incomes. And for lower income people, their incomes actually went up a bit. And the reason why is because we have transferred income through our tax system. So things like the payroll holiday, things like unemployment benefits, food stamps, Medicaid, all help cushion the most vulnerable during the recession. Now, the trick is, what happens now that the economy is starting to grow? Are we pulling these subsidies, pulling away the safety net too soon while people are still on the tightrope? Are we taking away the safety net too soon?
I would have to say yes. If that's a question that you're posing, yes. The way the economy is going today, a lot of these subsidies and such are now drying up or being redistributed mm-hmm. In favor of other things that may make another area of the world or of the United States, another form of government, more whole, so
well,
to speak.
What we saw in December is that 1.3 million Americans lost their unemployment insurance benefits, even though they still haven't found a job.
Right.
And the long-term unemployed, if you look at that labor employment report a few days ago, you'll see that long-term unemployed is still a significant problem in the United States. Those people who have been out of work for 6 months or more, even though they're looking, still exist, and that iceberg hasn't melted. And yet we've ended a program meant to help stabilize incomes. So while there's a lot of deliberation on the monetary side, we always talk about the Fed and fiscal policy right. being data-driven, and we're not going to pull away stimulus too fast, there doesn't seem to be the same amount of deliberation when it comes to fiscal policy.
We've got a lot of people, obviously, without jobs in the United States, and that number recently came out, I guess it was a week or so ago, where it's higher than it's not ever been, but it's higher than it has been in previous months.
Well, you know, there has been some gains in employment over the year. What we saw with this last jobs report is a really unexpected decline. It was at 74,000 jobs after having been, you know, around 200,000 2 months
jobs.
Before.
I don't think it's that surprising. Seasonal jobs now ending. There's no need for them anymore. Bye-bye.
Yeah,
have
perhaps.
A good day. Welcome to the unemployment pool. Oh, by the way, we're going to take that insurance
perhaps.
Away now.
But even that, even given that, it's a little, it came a little faster than expected.
Right.
And so...
got to get them out before the benefits stick.
Before the benefits,
we're going to start paying for benefits. That's all.
There you go. That's smart.
Yeah.
But what it tells us, though, is that this is going to be a bumpy ride. We're not going to see a smooth increase in the labor market every month. We'll see stops and starts and false promises on the way to a labor market recovery. And what it also tells us is that you can't just look at the headline unemployment rate. The unemployment rate, Alan, actually went down to 6.7%, but that is because the labor market participation rate, the amount of people in the jobs market, either employed or looking for jobs, is at a three-decade low.
Right.
People have given up. And until people are engaged in the labor market again, you're going to see, one, and a low unemployment rate, but also a tepid labor market.
Obviously, elections, we talked about it a minute ago, coming up. Are there any plans, or what I say, dare I say, are there any plans in place for the Republicans or the Democrats to make this to make us whole again with regard to employment? What are their thoughts?
So absolutely. We're starting to see the beginnings of a plan with the Democrats in terms of extending unemployment benefits insurance that's had some bipartisan support, though Republicans' answer is, how are you going to pay for it? You know, we also have this deficit issue that's growing. And while Democrats would argue that we should use deficit spending to pay for unemployment insurance benefits, that would be about $25 billion to extend benefits this year. Republicans are going to ask, how do you pay for that? So we're also going to see on the Democrat side some thoughts towards increasing the minimum wage. And you see that locally in counties and states already, this movement to increase the minimum wage. Now, on the Republican side, Senator Mark Rubio has had some answer to what to do about poverty. Now, it's important, of course, as an economist, not to conflate income inequality with something that's structural like poverty.
Sure.
But still, it answers a call that Republicans do care about people who are not in the top 1%, right? So his ideas are to really make states more accountable in anti-poverty programs, give that flexibility to states, take it away from the federal government, and really structure it around reform and giving more power to the states.
Talking about giving more power to the states, you kind of mentioned it a moment ago. By the way, you're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, where my guest is Dr. Neela Richardson, Senior Economic Analyst with Bloomberg Government. We're discussing the economy as a whole. It's 2014, and we're still dealing with a lot of the same issues. Just because the calendar changed, we made it up to the top of the hill, doesn't mean that the issues have disappeared. We're still dealing with some unemployment rates that are astronomical. Unemployment insurance is drying up or going away in a lot of cases, and it's leaving a lot of people standing there with that empty bag. And We've seen recently a lot of local municipalities, states, governments, and such, countywide, especially in the state of Maryland, are now allowing or coming up with rules saying, hey, let's raise this to the minimum wage to a fair wage. And it's actually starting to bump in 2015. Wouldn't it be prudent for them to just go ahead and make a blanket change rather than allowing the municipalities to make these decisions? Right. Let's normalize it across the country.
Right. So in previous times, you know, states have led the way in terms of minimum wage increases, but it had been followed pretty swiftly with a federal increase in minimum wage. Now, right now, that doesn't look too likely. There's too many other issues of disagreement. There's not a lot of bipartisan support for an increase in minimum wage. So you may get this patchwork quilt of wages in this country. And it's not just state differences. You'll see locality differences. Here in the DC metro area, you see Prince George's County and Montgomery County having a much higher minimum wage standard than other counties in the state of Maryland. Sure. You'll see that in the District of Columbia. You'll see differences between the district and Virginia. And right. So in this very mobile economy, you see different wage standards. And so academia has not really solved or answered or done research on the question of what happens when localities that are very close together have such different wage standards. What does that do to business? What does that do to mobility? What does that do to labor?
Right.
We don't know.
That's exactly where I was headed with this. We're all about the business implications of government actions. And if a government has said, now you, Mr. Shop Owner, has to minimally pay an employee X amount of dollars, which is maybe $2 or $3 above what you could afford to pay. Now you have to peddle your wares more expensive to be able to, does that then in turn cause the landlord of the facility that in to raise the rent? You know, is this a problem that is going to bubble up to the point at which more people are going to end up unemployed because people can't afford to have a business?
Well, that would definitely be the Republican argument. Look, there's been research done on this.
Oh, really? Sorry, go ahead.
There's been research done on this at the state level where they looked at conjoined counties between one state and another, and they found that there's really been no effect if one county, let's say in New Jersey, raises their minimum wage and a county in Pennsylvania does not. That's what the state of the literature has said so far. But the state of the literature is silent on what happens within a state. And that's what we don't know, how differences within a state. If you're Walmart and you have a decision of where you can locate, would that minimum wage really be a very impactful, influential factor in your decision?
You mentioned Walmart. Huge debate right here in D.C. Mm-hmm. with the amount of money that an employee at Walmart should make, minimally. Mm-hmm. Walmart walked away the winner. Mm-hmm. Has it been a detriment to the area surrounding? No one knows at this point. However, the employees, I bet you are pretty happy.
Yeah, you know, what the case of Walmart that's been made is that the Walmart worker is also the Walmart employee. So the idea is that you increase wages at Walmart, they'll spend money in Walmart.
That's true.
Much like what was done during the Ford Revolution when Henry Ford made the decision to increase the wages of the auto workers and they bought cars. But, you know, that argument breaks down a bit now because now we're in a global economy and there's no loyalty. I mean, there's no reason for loyalty. There's no reason why a Walmart worker should shop at Walmart. Maybe there's sick of being in Walmart all day. And they want to shop at Target. They want to shop online. They want to shop at the grocery store, at the Whole Foods, at Wegmans. There's choice, right? And so we shouldn't expect that just because Walmart pays more money, that Walmart sees more returns. And that's why at the end of the day, if you want to do a social policy, you need a government agent to act as the social benefactor, not a company. Now, governments can do a lot to incentivize companies in a certain direction, but just to expect Walmart out of its own corporate self-interest to do it is a little, I think, misguided.
I don't know, that 25-cent Sam's Club soda. Not bad. Out of the machine in the front. Interesting story about Walmart. We'll have to see what happens. It's definitely a case study in progress at this point.
Right, but what we do know, Alan, is that we will hear this income inequality refrain over the next 9 months. This is a voting issue. Mm-hmm. People care about the minimum wage, and that cuts across parties. We still have a labor market problem in this country, and so employment insurance is not going away. So these are issues that are not going away, and it's going to be interesting how the two parties try to solve these really important problems, and then again, how they sell it to the voting public.
It's something that I know that you'll be tracking for us and bring us more as they develop. And her name is Dr. Neela Richardson. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Alan. It's been a pleasure.
To learn more about Bloomberg Government, simply call us at 877-498-3587. Bloomberg Government.
Bloomberg Government.
Where business and politics come together. Welcome back to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact, right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, where my guest right now is a senior technology analyst with Bloomberg Government, a man who's a world traveler, knows quite a bit, one of the biggest brained people I know. His name is Sanford Reback. How are you?
I'm great, Alan. How are you?
I'm doing well. Welcome to 2014 and welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
So we're talking about a topic here that I know we discussed late last year where the ball kind of got rolling, and it's the cybersecurity framework. NIST has finally said, oh yeah, we're going to launch this framework, we're going to get everybody, but it's voluntary.
Correct.
Completely voluntary.
Yep.
Where are we with this now, and have they made any strides towards making it more mandatory?
Well, where we are is, I think, in terms of the framework, we're at the end stages. NIST is supposed to come out with this maybe the second week of February at this point, although that date could always slip. And so in, at least in terms of where the framework itself is, it's almost done. Now, NIST has said that this is framework version, you know, 1.0,
right,
and they expect there to be modifications going forward, but NIST is going to publish something soon. In terms of making it more more mandatory, nothing. In fact, NIST has gone to great pains, as has the entire administration, the Obama administration at this point, to be very clear that this is not intended to establish new standards.
All right. So now I look at parenting. Kind of making a little analogy here with regard to parenting. There is no reason for anyone to want to adopt these standards. Number one, the incentive that they've offered, unlike an incentive that I offer a child, would be my son, hey, we'll play Lego after you brush your teeth. In this case, it's you adopt these standards, and from what I can gather so far from reading cybersecurity framework advances as incentives lag, incentives are certainly lagging, because right now it's just like a little sticker you can stick on the window that says, hey, we're compliant. There's nothing more than that at this point.
I think that's right. And so industry has been, of course, very, very concerned. Here's the problem with putting a document like this out. A cybersecurity breach, if it happens, can be really bad and you can lose a lot of money.
Right.
Cybersecurity itself is really expensive. So you have to actually invest in systems and personnel to make sure that your network is as secure as it can be. So it requires you to put out a lot of money to avoid something that probably isn't going to happen in terms of a really bad event. So you have to put money out there, and what kind of return do you see on that? It's not clear. So a lot of companies out there, they're private, but they're also public companies, got shareholders, and say, okay, we're paying all this money. What's happened?
Right.
Well, we haven't had a big attack. It makes it a little difficult. Now, there are some incentives.
Big attacks are all relative. I don't mean to cut you off.
Sure.
I mean, obviously, we're talking about power grids. We're talking about things that are massive that could be detrimental to hundreds of millions of people. But look at the hundreds of millions of people who were impacted by both Neiman Marcus and Target. I'm imagining both of those companies will be happy to put those stickers on their front doors.
Well, I mean, you bring up a lot of interesting points here. So this kind of framework right now, the NIST framework coming out in February, isn't even directed to stores, companies like Neiman Marcus and Target. It's really focused on critical infrastructure.
Okay.
So it is focused on, you know, the water treatment plants, the energy grid, all those other kinds of things where there's kind of a national security. We need these things to stay up, or we're all really in deep doo-doo.
I don't know about you. I shop at Target. I don't need my card stolen again, by the way. Yes, my card was taken.
Well, you know, Target breach could have affected as many as over 100 million separate accounts.
Yeah.
You in this room, my wife shops at Target. We're still kind of scrutinizing the credit card bills as they come in. And so one of the questions is, will this framework begin to seep in and kind of become a way of doing business?
Right.
And the way that, you know, the incentive may be for companies is, if you don't adopt this framework and someone takes you to court and sues you, they're going to point to this and say, why haven't you at least done that? The government's come out with some standards that it recommends, and you haven't done that, you owe us X tens of billions, you know, tens of millions of dollars. And that might be a way that will cajole companies to go forward.
Me as the defense attorney would go, it's not mandatory. I don't have to. What's the point?
Well, right. I mean, and I think that is, it remains to be seen how, yeah. you know, lawyers, as you know, lawyers among the smartest people in the world, he says is a lawyer, but it remains to be seen the kinds of cases, how powerful the arguments can be from some of these plaintiff lawsuits. There's another way that the companies could be hit, and that's a shareholder derivative suit. Shareholders come in and say, okay, Target, you had this massive breach. You didn't do A, B, and C. The stock declined because of this reason, and we're going to want some of that because you, the executives, didn't do what you were supposed to.
It might be the path that we're looking at this point, considering the volume of people who are stepping up to the plate. And hey, I wasn't. Yes, my information was stolen. My bank did send me a letter saying, hey, we got some issues. We need to talk. and I'm taking care of everything that needs to be taken care of. And I'm obviously monitoring everything moving forward. But you've got the possibility of identity theft now, given all the volume of information that was shared. And I just hope that the person who steals my identity has a better life than me. That's all I can wish of someone who steals my identity.
I don't know. You look, I mean,
my life is pretty good.
No, I was going to say that to people around BGov. You know, yeah. You seem to have a pretty ideal life at this point.
My life is pretty good. I'm not going to lie. I have a good time. But, hopefully if they do steal it, then that person has a better time than I.
Well, so one of the things that is worth keeping an eye on as we go forward in these next months in Congress is whether these breaches really prompt more congressional efforts to do things in cyber that would apply not just to critical infrastructure,
right.
which is critically important, obviously,
right.
but also to places where people shop. You know, if you think about it, there are safety standards for automobiles. You know, automakers have to include seat belts and airbags at this point. You know,
right.
years ago, I mean, I'm old enough to say I can remember, there weren't. I remember my dad installing seat belts in one of the cars that we had,
wow.
because at that point it wasn't a requirement and the government just instituted that as a safety measure. Will there be more talk about instituting some requirements on companies as a safety measure? Because the things that you talked about, you know, obviously this can be expensive, but identity theft can be an unbelievable hassle.
Sure.
And it affects a lot of people. And if you add up the total economic cost, it's very, very significant to the economy.
Sure.
So, you know, will we see that in Congress coming up? I wouldn't bet on it, but I think there'll be a lot more discussion now since Target than there would have been before.
2014 has gotten underway. What can we expect? What's going to be the next step in this hurdle? Obviously, early February is when the requirements come out. Requirements, and I'm saying that loosely because it's not really required.
Standards.
Standards will be released.
Yep.
What's next in the timeline?
Well, in terms of the NIST cybersecurity framework, I think we're looking at the standards coming out in February, and then the White House says that there will be more information about incentives to come. So I would expect maybe by mid-year or something, we'll see a few things. Now, what they may end up saying is, you know, we from the government can give you a good housekeeping sticker of approval, but we need Congress to do some of these things that are more important. So we'll right. work with you to get Congress to do those things. I think the other thing we'll see is the framework taken by specific agencies that have responsibility for parts of critical infrastructure. The agency that oversees the chemical industry, for example, or the Department of Energy that oversees right. the grid and things like that, they'll take these standards and they'll try to put some meat on the bones. And some of this may become much more specific and more mandatory as the days go on.
You'll not only get a sticker, but we'll provide you with a GIF file you can put on your website.
not that we're cynical about these efforts
at
all.
Not at all. Healthcare.gov. Not at all. Not at all. Sandy, as usual, thank you very much for being here, part of the program.
Always happy to be here, Alan. Thanks a lot.
It's Cybersecurity Framework Advances as Incentives Lag. You could say that again. His name is Sanford Reback, Senior Technology Analyst with Bloomberg Government. And with that, we wrap up this week's edition of Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. Follow us on Twitter at BGov. Follow me on Twitter at Alan L. Scott. I'll catch you next Thursday at 11 with plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, my name is Alan Scott.